seeing absence. So sometimes we seem to see absences. A standard example is the experience of the absence of a sought-for item in the place where one is searching. My iPhone isn't here. Are such experiences genuinely perceptual? Not according to the Buddhist Dharmakirti. Dharmakirti argues instead that they are belief-based, much as we saw Buddhists before him similarly arguing that amodal completion, the experience of holes, is belief-based. Dharmakirti's view is that what an experience of the absence of an object consists in is an inference to a belief in the object's absence based on the failure to perceive the object in circumstances where the conditions for its perceptibility are met. That's in Nyabindu 43. So there's a counterfactual, enthymematic major premise that were the object to be present, you would perceive it. A belief-based account of absence experience holds that we don't perceive absences, but infer to a belief that something is absent on the basis of what we do perceive. Yet here too, and for reasons analogous to those we encountered in reviewing the claims of amodally completed and illusory experiences to be perceptual in nature, doxastic views are to be resisted. First, forming a judgment takes time and conscious effort, whereas experiences of absence typically feel instantaneous and effortless. Furthermore, experiences of absence are often insensitive to belief. Even if one came to form a belief that the object is present, the experience of absence may persist. Anna Franikova gives a nice example of this, the photograph of Venezuelan gymnast Catherine Coronel, who looks completely headless while performing her routine. As Franikova notes, the phenomenology is not that of the head being occluded by the gymnast's body, and there's a qualitative difference between the experience of absence and the experience of holes with occluded parts. Experiencing something as absent is not the same as experiencing something as present but hidden. On some such grounds, Nya philosophers maintain that Nya realism is true even of absence experience, thereby committing themselves to a seventh metaphysical category, that of absences, as well as to a proprietary perceptual relation acquainting observers with its members. As Mahadeva Puntamkara summarizes the Nya view in his 17th century Nya Kaustubha, in fact, positing the sensory perception of absence is correct because there are experiences such as are reported as I observed the absence of the water jug on the ground, which are demonstrably correlated with sensory perception. Well, few nowadays are likely to want to follow Nya philosophers in their synthesis of metaphysical realism about absences and naive realism about the perception of absence. An obvious objection is that absences are not the right sorts of things to serve as causes in the causal history of a perceptual experience. And to recall, naive realism presupposes that there is a basic causal theory to explain why it is that apples but not atoms can be perceived. A related objection is that there's no relation of conscious perceptual acquaintance holding between observers and absences. It's true that in the case of illusion, as we saw last week, Nayakas are willing to postulate anomalous relations of acquaintance with absent and mislocated features. But such relations present the feature as present, and that's just what it is to be a relation of acquaintance. No relation of acquaintance can present an absence as absent. So here we must part company with Motilal, who in his book Perception does not discuss the experience of absence, other than to say, in connection with the difference between perceptual experience and linguistic understanding, that linguistic understanding is possible even in the absence of the object, but perception cannot arise when the object is not there. The best developed analysis of absence experience is to be found instead in the writings of a brilliant Bengali philosopher from a previous generation, Krishnachandra Bhattacharya. In chapter 4 of his justly celebrated classic, The Subject as Freedom, Bhattacharya argues for 3 distinctive and original claims. First, there are 2 kinds of absence experience. In one, the experience is of an object being absent from a place. In the other, the look of the place is as empty or devoid. The first case is illustrated by the experience of a person who is looking for a book but does not find it. The second, by a field wearing a bare look after a tree has been felled. The 2 kinds of absence experience involve, we might say, on the one hand, a proprietary sort of seeing in, as when one sees in the room the absence of a book, and on the other, an absential look, as when a field looks bare. The first kind is the one Sartre analyses in Being and Nothingness, the case of Pierre perceived to be absent from the cafe. An example of the second kind of absence experience is given by Brian O'Shaughnessy, who analyses the experience of looking at a blank expanse of white letter paper, seeing it as devoid of a signature. Secondly, Bhattacharya claims that both kinds of absence experience are genuinely perceptual, and he describes the nature of the perceptual experience involved as imaginative perception or aesthetic perception. At the end of this lecture, I'll offer some reasons why aesthetic perception is a good choice of designator. And I'll relate our discussion of absence experience with Volheim's 2 perceptual projects hypothesis. Bhattacharya argues that in both cases, a mechanism is involved, consisting in the contrast between the perception of the place as it is and the imagination of the absent object as located in that place. He says that what's imaginally distinguished within the perception is the imagined object as present from the perceived object as absent. Imagination here is not a faculty of free fancy, but the ability to manipulate mental imagery. Bhattacharya's third claim is that absence experience of either kind can undergo a transformation into non-perceptual cognitive states, which Bhattacharya calls states of conscious non-perception. In the first kind of case, one's attention shifts from the missing book to the room in which it's absent. And in the second case, one's attention shifts from the bare look of the field to the tree which is no longer there. The transformation is not inferential, and the resulting state is not perceptual. It must rather, he claims, quote, be recognized as a new mode of knowledge. The transformation is of the book that's perceived by sense being turned into the imagined character of location of the imagined book, he says. Having perceived my book to be missing, my attention shifts instead to the room, which now seems to me to be devoid of book. Having perceived the field looking bare, I tend instead to the tree, which now seems to me to be gone. It's not quite clear to me what Bhattacharya has in mind with his talk of a transformation. The procedure might be thought to consist in what Sven Irvinson calls a transformation in attending, such as the spontaneous reversals of the Necker cube, or of multi-stable figures like the duck rabbit, or in shifts in covert attention. Such transformations are non-deductive restructurings of the figure-ground relationship in the field of consciousness. Another possibility is that what Bhattacharya has in mind is the idea that absence experience provides non-inferential reasons for knowledge of absence, so that the transformation in question is one from perceptual experience into judgment. This would then constitute a dogmatic claim about the justification of judgments about absence. As Jim Pryor puts it, the dogmatist about perceptual justification says that when it perceptually seems to you as if P is the case, you have a kind of justification for believing P that does not presuppose or rest on your justification for anything else which could be cited as an argument for P. To have this justification for believing P, you need only have an experience that represents P as being the case. According to the naive realist, to claim that a perceptual episode is presentational is to claim that the mind-independent objects and their qualities are constitutive of the episode in a manner such that those objects and qualities determine the phenomenal character of the episode. What then determines the phenomenal character of an episode of absence experience? Bhattacharya writes that an object may be directly known to be now absent, to be present as absent, in this sense, a paradoxical phrase to be justified presently. So let me attempt a reconstruction of his analysis of the paradoxical concept of presence as absent and compare it against contemporary theories of absence experience. Images have an essential role to play in Bhattacharya's analysis of absence experience. For it's only by way of an imagined contrast that of all the absences that are there in the room, one particular and specific absence, that of my book, is the one I attend to. A target for my visual search is provided by a mental image of the missing book. Absence experience then consists in a sort of pop-out attention, the object's absence jumping out in the perceived scene, having been made salient by imagining a scene in which it's present. Bhattacharya claims that a perceptual experience of the book being absent is, quote, with the conscious imagination of the book as found being distinct from it, adding that one may come to imagine the room as with the book and then realise its absence in reference to this imagined content. To imagine the absence of an object at a perceived place, therefore, is to superimpose a mental image of the object onto the perceived scene. The contrast with the actual contents of the perceived scene causing one's attention to be grabbed by the object's absence. So the experience of absence involves what Briscoe calls make-perceive, the augmentation of reality by means of the superimposition of a mental image, and a contrast between a scene thus augmented and the scene as it is actually given. As an illustration of all these various facets of Bhattacharya's analysis, consider René Magritte's well-known painting, Man with a Newspaper. Let's suppose that our attention moves clockwise from upper left to upper right, and then from lower right to lower left. The upper left frame cues an expectation, so that what grabs our attention when we attend to the upper right frame is the absence of the man with the newspaper. One's perceptual experience is of the absence of the man in the room. The lower right frame familiarises us with the new situation, however, and by the time we arrive at the lower left frame, we no longer expect to see the man, but now expect not to see him, or else have no expectation at all. So the quality of our visual experience of the fourth scene differs from that of the second. What we now see is the room as unoccupied, as wearing an unoccupied look, rather than the man's absence. Bhattacharya's claim, I think, is that the difference is in how the scene is perceived, rather than in what is perceived. An experience of absence, then, is one in which the field of consciousness is structured into figure and ground, and where mental imagery supplies an image of the absent object. In his earlier writings, Bhattacharya exploits a new concept of what he calls negative attention. He says, this is from a paper from 1914, "We know the absence of an object, say a book on the table, by a faculty which is neither perception nor inference. It's not perception, for the absence gives no sensation, and it cannot be inference, for inference must be based on perception. The faculty, however, being there, it may be helped out by the perception or inference. The non-existence of a book on the table is an objective fact known by negative attention, defined by relation to the facts obtained by positive attention." Negative attention here is attention to wants, lacks, losses and lacunae, to the missing and the misplaced. And negative attention continues to form an important function in Bhattacharya's thought, even when he subsequently changes his mind about the status of absence experience as perceptual. When attention is given to something present, the perceived figure is a unified and consolidated whole. That's why it can stand out against the background, as in the case of the numeral 4 in the diagram figure 3. As Gerwich put it, the figure is a Gestalt contextur, organized as a unitary whole of varying degrees of richness in detail, which, by virtue of its intrinsic articulation and structure, possesses coherence and consolidation, and thus detaches itself as an organized and closed unit from the surrounding field. An absence lacks any such structure. It's presented as lacking in spatial contours or location. So negative attention to absence, Bhattacharya says, is the consciousness of presentness without space position. Or as Sartre put it, Pierre's absence haunts the cafe and is not localized in any particular place within the cafe. So the absence of my sought-for book is not a Gestalt contexture. The absence itself is not a figure against a background. Rather, what we should say is that this absence is a vacancy in the figure position. Although my experience is structured so as to have the book as figure and the room as ground, the book is not there. Sven Arvidsson echoes Bhattacharya when he puts it that the figure is presented as absent. He writes, "Sometimes the theme is evanescent, as in Sartre's famous example of looking for Pierre in the cafe, and he's not there. Everywhere in the cafe, what's attended to is Pierre presented as absent against the contextual background of the cafe. It's like searching for the hidden weeds among a thick lawn cover. The content in thematic attention is not nothing, it's something. As soon as the weed presents itself as a theme, the previous theme of weed presented as absent, an evanescent flickering of thematic content, is replaced by the weed as present." Now, this distinction, it's hard to keep in mind as long as we allow ourselves to be in the grip of the metaphor of attention as a spotlight. Gerwich was himself strongly critical of this metaphor because it implies that only the theme is illuminated in consciousness while the rest of the field is in darkness. If there are fields of consciousness in which absence is thematic, the metaphor is doubly misleading, because an absence is not the right type of thing to be illuminated. The way it shows up and is made thematic is not by being lit up in a torchlight's beam. What we need to make sense of the idea of negative attention is Anne Treisman's alternative metaphor, that of attention as a window. The window analogy, she writes, implies that irrelevant features are actively excluded or suppressed, perhaps because without attention, random conjunctions of the features present are unconsciously formed. And again, she writes, selection is controlled extrinsically by a spatial aperture or window that can be narrowly focused or more widely opened. Suppose what we're searching for is a blue horizontal, there being no blue horizontal among the presented shapes, all of which are red or vertical. What we should now say is that the window of attention is open only to those feature conjunctions that meet the search criterion, so that there is, in this case, nothing in the window of attention. Attention to absence is a sort of limit case in the model of attention as a window of exclusion, the case where what is in the window is the absence of anything meeting the search criterion, everything having been excluded. The search is guided by a mental picture of a blue horizontal, defining what the window is open to. The figure position is the shape of the window, the frame, defined as what's not excluded. It's a kind of anyapoa, as Dignaga might have said. The frame is determined by an image of a blue horizontal, excluding anything non-blue and non-horizontal. The figures presenting as absent is represented in this metaphor by the windows being empty. There's nothing that the window is open to. So what determines the phenomenal character of an experience of absence is not an object occupying the figure position, a mind-independent object of perceptual acquaintance, but rather a vacancy within the figure position, a position circumscribed by mental imagery. Mental imagery is what defines the frame of the window of attention itself, and the absence of anything within the window as so framed is what gives meaning to the concept of the presence as absent of the absent object. Something of this same idea is captured by Sartre when he writes in his book, The Imaginary, of the imagined Pierre as being such that this Pierre in relation to whom the situation is defined is precisely Pierre absent. Although he otherwise conflates the distinction between the idea of an absence as itself the figure and the different idea of an emptiness in the figure position. As Bhattacharya put the matter in a later essay entitled Objective Interpretation of Percept and Image, 1936, he wrote, to be conscious of a spatial object as perceived is to be conscious of a percept, and to be conscious of it as unperceived is to be conscious of an image. Yet, as we saw in our discussion of direct representationalism, the first lecture, we should not conflate the role of the image as provider of content with the different idea of the object of perception. A visual template of the absent object performs a certain role in the mechanism of absence experience. And in many cases, it's better to think of the role as more like a subconscious visual template than consciously experienced imagery. In his neglected book, The Subject of Consciousness, Cedric Evans characterizes this role as consisting in serving as a guiding idea, insofar as it provides the searcher with a success condition for their search. He says, it may be that he has in mind a certain image of what Pierre might be looking like and how he might be seated. He would then be looking for that state of affairs, and nothing that did not gel with the image would be the focus of attention. The image will guide the search. Evans is right to say that, to continue, we may look upon a guiding idea as a partial filter that lets through those noticings that are germane to the search, and at the same time keeps down the number of extraneous noticings. But this guiding idea cannot itself be conceived of as the object of attention during the search. Were it to become so, instead of prosecuting the search, the attender would at best be engaged in planning a search, and at worst he would be merely distracted by an idea. Well, let me next compare Bhattacharya's analysis, insofar as I've tried to reconstruct it, with contemporary work on absence experience. Anna Faranikova proposes a model of absence perception, according to which the experience of an absence is the experience of a mismatch between what's expected and what's perceived in the course of a visual search. She writes, visual experience of O's absence consists in an object-level mismatch between O's template generated by visual working memory and a percept of the observed stimulus. Thus, you are certain that you had brought your keys into the house. You look and look, but the keys are nowhere to be found. Here's a breakdown of the process. Prior to searching, you generate a visual template of the keys in your working memory. Next, you project this template and match it against the places where you typically leave your keys, where in projection you attend to the template of your keys for the purpose of comparing it with the world. An experience of the absence of your keys will involve a mismatch between their template and the places viewed during search. A respect in which Faranikova's account improves on Bhattacharya's is in its appeal to visual templates rather than mental images. She writes that one might be tempted to think of visual templates as images or visualizations of the absent object. But this way to conceptualize templates may invite confusion. Images often refer to mental pictures consciously or intentionally generated by the subject. Although perception of absence often uses templates of that sort, For example, an image of your laptop may flash before your eyes when you discover its absence. It doesn't have to. Templates of objects may be produced at the subpersonal level, projected involuntarily, and lack the vivacity of conscious imagery. Importantly, she notes that templates need not be conceptual. Quote, while time constraints, memory flaws, or lack of the relevant conceptual apparatus may prevent us from appropriately cognizing an absence, they don't prevent us from experiencing one. That's another point in favor of a perceptualist account of absence experience over Dermacurti's belief-based account. An important difference between the accounts has to do with their explanations of the phenomenology. What is it like to experience absence? The phenomenology of absence, Fernikova writes, is the experience of incongruity. Martin and Dokic point out, however, that feelings of incongruity are metacognitive, and that if her claim is correct, it would be redundant to postulate a perceptual experience of absence over and above a metacognitive affect. They argue that the mismatch in question can equally well be interpreted as giving rise not to a perceptual experience of absence, but to a meta-perceptual feeling of surprise or unexpectedness. In their metacognitive account, we do not see absences, but we may feel surprised when there's an absence of seeing, a feeling whose function, they say, is to help the subject to avoid or reduce epistemic inconsistency. So an absence perceptualist ought not to be committed to the thesis that incongruity constitutes the phenomenology of absence. And indeed, neither surprise nor incongruity is essential to the phenomenology of absence experience. Cavendon Taylor offers, as a counterexample, tactually perceiving a tooth to be absent in one's mouth after its extraction. He characterizes the phenomenology thus. He says, the gap is not merely perceived as an empty space between two objects, i.e. the teeth that mark the boundaries of the gap. Rather, it's tactually perceived as a location at which a tooth is now missing. Something once experienced as present within your mouth is now experienced as lacking. In such a case, there's no feeling of surprise, and so the phenomenology of surprise is not central to any analysis of absence perception. While a feeling of incongruity may often accompany the experience of absence, especially in cases of failed search and thwarted expectation, such feelings do not constitute the phenomenology. The right account of the phenomenology is that it's one of negative attention, of an experience with a figure ground structure where the figure position is empty. Cavendon Taylor writes, Fernikova is wrong about incongruity constituting the phenomenology of absence experience. A second difficulty with Fernikova's account has to do with the central role it gives to expectations. If absence experience is a matter of violations of expectations in unsuccessful searches, what about cases when an object's absence is expected? Farenikova argues that we should rethink the nature of the mismatches in question, which are, she says, to be understood not as errors or discrepancies between what we expect and what we see, but as contrast between what we project from memory and imagination and what we see. Thus, even if you expect a person to be absent, you still confirm their absence by the process of projection and mismatch described. So in expectation-based accounts of absence perception, expectations matter for perception of absence because they explain why we activate, project, and match templates of certain objects. That is to say, templates signal not only what objects one expects to be present, but also what objects one expects to be absent. Farenikova's own examples of expected absence are: tourists travelling in the desert will expect to see no trees. An observer will expect the sun to disappear behind the ocean line. Yet, and I think this is precisely why Bhattacharya distinguishes absential looks from absence experience in failed search, a place can look bare or empty without there being any expectation at all. So let me turn to the topic of absential looks. Bhattacharya's idea is that in cases like the ones just mentioned, the desert landscape simply wears an empty or bare look, where such absential looks do not imply or require any expectation, either to see a tree or to see its absence. The second kind of absence experience he identifies do not involve failed visual search, are not grounded in expectation, and are not associated with a phenomenology of surprise or incongruity. Brian O'Shaughnessy has also identified absence experience of this second sort, writing, "Instead of the expected signature at the end of a letter, you see a blank white paper. You say, 'I saw that there was no name.' This reports an experience of absence, which is not to be confused with effective experiences like surprise, which frequently attend it. The experience happened as you saw it and registered the presence of a pure expanse of white. You say, 'In seeing the white, I saw there was no signature.' Therefore, timing the experience and internally linking it to the seeing of white. What can be the nature of this link? What sort of in-seeing is this? I submit," he continues, "that the experience of seeing the absence of X is a cognitive experience such that we experience the visual object as a presence endowed with a negative property. For example, we see the pure expanse of white as an unsigned upon white expanse, and so to say, bereft in a certain regard." Bhattacharya himself introduces the idea by way of a new example in which one becomes aware that there used to be a tree in the field in which one is now standing, a tree that has now gone. He writes, "A tree, for example, was observed in the past, a field, sorry, for example, was observed in the past with a tree standing on it, which might or might not have been particularly noticed at the time. The observer comes to the place when the tree has been removed and finds a new bare look about the place. He may not know that it's the absence of the tree that makes the difference, but he notices the difference, bareness or absence. The absence of the tree is known as a character of the locus, the perceived field where the tree stood. The tree may not be definitely remembered, but if remembered, it's recognized to be the specification of the absence that continues to be known, the place not ceasing to wear the bare look because of the definite memory. As the place is perceived, absence as a character of the place may also claim to be perceived. There is, however, a distinction between the sense in which absence is a character and that in which a quality like colour is a character of the place. The place in being perceived with the bareness or absence is, if not perceived, then at least imagined as what need not have the character, being presented as with a new look, or in other words, as distinct from what it might be. But to perceive the place with a colour is not necessarily to imagine that it might be without it. The perceived locus of absence being imagined in the very perception of it as without the absence is only a floating adjective that, unlike colour, is felt to be dissociated from the locus. The perception of the absence may be called aesthetic or imaginative perception to distinguish it from ordinary perception." So the field is perceived, and it's perceived as looking bare, as lacking in some as yet inspecific way. "I've not yet consciously remembered the tree, but simply see the field as having a bare look about it. I might retrieve a memory of the field as it was, perhaps indeed by journeying back to the field in episodic memory or mental time travel. I compare in imagination the contents of my retrieved memory with the presented scene, memory now supplying imagination with an image to be manipulated. There's thus a distinction between the fields looking bare as having an empty look and its looking green. Bareness is a floating adjective in the sense that in attributing it of a place, one imagines the place as what need not have it. Part of what it is to see the field as bare is to imagine it as otherwise, an aesthetic or imaginative perception, as opposed to the ordinary perception of qualities like colour, simple givens in the seen environment." So consider what you might experience if you go to visit the Sycamore Gap. We might distinguish between two cases. In the first, you don't know that the tree has been cut down, and what you experience is the mismatch between what you'd expected to see and what you in fact see. Here, surprise and incongruity accompany the experience. In the second case, you do know that the tree has gone, and your experience is not driven by incongruity and surprise. Rather, you experience the veil as having, in Bhattacharya's words, an empty look. Something similar is perhaps true of the way the world appears to one who is grief-struck. It's not the absence of the person that strikes one, but a certain emptiness in the world itself. We might think of the role of mental imagery in such cases in terms of the concept of solicitation. Hubert Dreyfus explains that affordance, a term introduced by Gibson, is used to describe objective features of the world in terms of their meaning to the creatures that use them. Thus, a hole affords hiding to a rabbit, but not to an elephant. To us, floors afford walking on, apples afford eating. Dreyfus notes that the Gestaltists were unhappy with the term affordance. They were interested not in our perception of objective features in the world, but in how such features are related to the needs and interests of perceivers. So they introduced the term solicitations. For Gibson, an apple affords eating, i.e. is edible, whether anyone is hungry or not. But the Gestaltist adds that only when one is hungry does an apple solicit eating, i.e. look delicious. So it's not that I now see the field simply as an expanse of green grass. It presents itself as a question, what used to be here? Imagining the place as with the tree is a condition on perceiving it aesthetically or imaginatively as without it, a condition which is met by regarding the tree as a solicitation of a particular sort, namely a solicitation to imagine the contrary. The tree, insofar as it's seen not merely as a green expanse, but as wearing a bare look, solicits imagining it as adorned. Now let me, in the final section, comment further on why Bhattacharya calls this aesthetic perception. I agree with Richard Volheim's claim that there are two projects for which our perceptual capacities might be enlisted. One project is to satisfy our visual interest or curiosity about an object present to the senses, Volheim's term for which is seeing face to face. Another project, however, is to have perceptual experiences of things that are not present to the senses, that is to say, both of things that are absent and also things that are non-existent. This, he says, involves the cultivation of a special kind of visual experience, which fastens upon certain objects in the environment for its furtherance, which is to say, visions of things not present now come about through looking at things present. The hallmark of such cultivated visual experience, which Volheim calls seeing in, is an indifference to or dissociation from the details of the thing present, because the spectator's essential concern is with the further visual experience of that which is absent. Seeings in are twofold, where twofoldness, he says, is the thesis that my visual attention must be distributed between two things, the requirement that I attend simultaneously to the object which is present and the one which is absent. And for Volheim, seeing in is a mode of perceptual experience unique to the experience of pictures and other representational works of art. Why does Bhattacharya describe experiences of absence as aesthetic experiences? There is indeed an analogy between absence experience and the perception of representational artworks. Nya philosophers have almost nothing to say about pictorial or other sorts of depictive perception. But I want to note that there are several intriguing points of affinity between our perception of depictions and our perception of absences. First of all, in both cases, an absence is in play. As Volheim writes, pictorial experiences are perceptual experiences of things that are not present to the senses, that is to say, both of things that are absent and also of things that are non-existent. Likewise, whenever it's an absence which is seen, there is always something which that is absent, a thing we might call the counterpositive of the absence, or simply the absentee. In the last lecture, my intention is to look at what Sanskrit theorists have said about the audience's perceptual experience in watching a play, when, of course, the portrayed subject isn't really there. A second point of comparison is that in both cases, the thing that is absent might be some particular thing or simply a thing of a certain kind. Volheim writes, told of a painting that it represents, say, a young woman, we might ask, which young woman? Now, for some pictures like the Ingres portrait, there's no answer to this question, even if the actual person we ask turns out not to know it. There is an answer to this question, even if the actual person we ask turns out not to know it. In such case, the picture represents a particular object. However, for other pictures, such as the genre picture by Manet, there's no answer to the question. And asking the question shows only that we've misunderstood what we've been told. In such cases, the painting represents merely an object or event of a particular kind. Volheim argues that this distinction does not apply in the case of seeing face to face. He says, if I claim to see a young woman face to face, I cannot, when asked which young woman, beg off and say that the question doesn't apply and that to ask it only betrays a misunderstanding of what I've said. A similar distinction applies in the case of perceptual experience of what's absent. The absence I report myself to see in a room might be that of a particular individual, or it might be of any object of a particular kind. The Nya philosophers encode this point in their distinction between specific and generic absences, vishesha bhava and samanya bhava. Indeed, an experience of the absence of the depicted subject is essential in our experience of representational artworks. So consider an iconic representation, such as the empty throne which represents the Buddha in early Buddhist art. Part of what it is to experience this as a representation of the Buddha is to have an experience of the Buddha's absence, which necessarily involves mental imagery of the Buddha himself. So the way in which an empty throne can depict the Buddha is precisely because of the way in which absence experience trades on mental imagery generated by the perceiver. And given that this process is subject-specific, the single empty throne represents the Buddha in as many ways as there are observers of it. So I'm going to have much more to say about the role of absence experience in aesthetics in the next final lecture. So thank you very much.